Hi, my name's Tim Oldman. I'm the founder and CEO of the Leaseman Index, the world's largest benchmarking and insight database on employee workplace experience. Since launching back in 2010, I've been fortunate enough to probe and debate the subject with some of the sector's best thought leaders, and these podcasts aim to package up some of those debates for you. One of those is here with me in Hoofddorp, just outside Amsterdam this afternoon. Kurt, why don't you introduce yourself?
I'm Kurt Zachariasse. I'm CEO of Delta Development Group. My passion is really in trying to make the world a little bit better by creating buildings and area developments that create not only financial value, but also social and ecological value, and most particularly focus on people inside buildings.
And we're here in one of your buildings that's been designed with and built for Plantronics.
Yes.
Somebody that we're close to. So tell us a little bit about this building from your perspective.
Well, this building, the Plantronics building, is part of Park 2020, a development which is inspired by the cradle-to-cradle thought. And that's this whole development and this building is also part of a personal journey that that I've taken over the years, actually. Delta is a family business. I took over my father's company in 2001. And when you take over someone else's company, you're sort of doing that in the way he always did it. And the first thing I did was order myself a bigger car, and I had a business card which says I was CEO of it. But in the morning when I looked in the mirror, you look at yourself, and I really felt that the horse was riding me a little bit rather than the other way around, and it didn't feel like it clicked with my own passions and values the way we did it.
When was this? Let's just get this in a
sort of
time frame.
Just around 2001, 2002. Mm-hmm. And shortly after that, I met Bill McDonough, architect and co-author of the book Cradle to Cradle. And I read his book, and it really struck a chord with me. The idea that sustainability is not just about less and trying to sort of do guilt management and manage the negative effects of what we're doing, but that it's actually a redesign of a system where you can create positive impacts with it, and by closing loops, actually keep perpetual value. And soon afterwards, I decided to pursue that thought also in my own business and use my own business as an engine for change. And when we did that, and you start to do that, you have to really rethink what you're doing. It means like a redesign. It means that you start using different materials. It starts that you look at your whole supply chain in a different way. And it really turned our whole business upside down. And then the crisis happened. And this was actually the moment that we started with our Park 2020 project, which was quite an ambitious scale. It's a 100,000 square meter office development here at Schiphol Airport. And it's the first cradle-to-cradle inspired area development where we try to do everything from the energy systems to the landscaping to the buildings according to that cradle-to-cradle philosophy. And at the same time, we had to do that in a very challenging financial situation because the market was shut down, financing was shutting down. So it really pushed us to think and rethink our business very, very carefully.
Did that mean that the types of people that we're talking to, the prospective tenants of this of the park, were a different type of audience? Did you find you were attracting a different quality of conversation with potential partners in the development?
Yes, definitely. What everyone did in a crisis was actually lower prices, lower quality, and try to do the minimum. And what we have actually done is raising quality, but using the idea of circularity and cradle to cradle really in a way that it improved the business cases over the long run. And it means that you need to change the dialogue with your client. And it starts first with defining what is your client. I mean, we tend also in the real estate to focus very much on the bricks and mortar and the actual building. But the real value of any building is always in the people. We build for people, whether that's residential, whether that is retail, whether that's office. It always centers around some human activity that needs to take place there.
Do you think that's true of all developers? Because I think certainly I can think of some instances where the idea of designing for people is about designing for one person, and that's probably the investor behind the scheme.
Absolutely.
Rather than the occupier. So is that what you're saying is different? You're now talking about, we're talking about employees.
Yeah.
Not funding parties or investors.
Well, what you want to do is you have to realize where does the chain start. In the end, it starts with the people working in a building that empower the business of the company renting that building. And then that company will pay the rent, which will satisfy an investor. If he is happy, he will pay me as a developer and I will pay the contractor and the engineers, etc. But the whole value chain starts in the end with the people working inside that building. If they don't function, if they're not happy, in the end, that tenant is going
to
leave.
So this is an inside-out approach.
Absolutely.
Almost to
Absolutely.
The traditional model. And to what extent does the quality or the intellectual inquiry that a client might have for that project? You've clearly got a thirst for building better buildings.
Yeah.
But to what extent does the quality of the client and their thirst to have a better built environment need to sit aligned with that? Have you found that the tenants that have come to Park 2020 are a different type and different stature, a different mentality of occupier?
Yes. Well, what I like to see is that, a lot of people, when they start as a tenant, this is a process that doesn't happen too often. You got more larger clients that have professional real estate divisions, and obviously they're fairly knowledgeable. But quite often, it starts with a tendering procedure, etc. What we've learned is that those clients that would fit us and that we could work with are those that could take the step and were becoming true partners with us. And usually, those are the people that come in with people in mind. I'd like to use the people, planet, profit triangle also as a commercial tool to see what predominant corner actually pushes the clients at that point. And what we see is quite often it's money, but also quite often it's people. And those clients that put their people first and see the value of people in the building are the people that we can actually have the best click with and where it's most enjoyable to work with.
Designers must love working with you because effectively you're allowing what can be very traditional models that developers continuously adopt. So things like standardized floor-to-ceiling height, standardized column grids, standardized facade treatments, that actually you're challenging that and allowing designers and the client to become part of the design team, it sounds like, as well. But actually that the end result here at Park 2020 is a whole series of very different buildings. There's no sense of a cookie-cutter solution being rolled out here.
No. What we try to do is we see our development process where we say, well, we want to continuously improve ourselves. So there's a standard that we keep. Then there's a client part, which is very important because in the end it's the client that drives the value chain and is at the basis of everything we do.
So we've been involved in something in the UK called the Stoddart Review, and I'll make sure we send you a copy of that, which challenged the real estate and facilities management industry with this question about why it is that as a sector we've been wholly focused on cost management and cost reduction and have almost been completely missed or have been blindsided by the idea that a piece of real estate like this can actively contribute to organizational performance rather than just act as a deficit against the profit account at the bottom line. So why have we struggled as a business, as an industry, for so long to get to that point of even asking the question, let alone make that jump to demonstrate to clients and organizations, occupiers, how these buildings can contribute?
Yeah. Well, to me, it has much to do, and it's interesting, I have a background in accountancy, actually. It has to do with the limited notion of how we measure value. We tend to focus very much on financial value and savings in rent. Is very tangible. An increase in productivity is measured in the end in turnover and bottom line, or in worker satisfaction, or the ability for a company to attract and hold talented staff. But that's much more an indirect relation, or perceived an indirect relation, and it's not something that comes as a line item back into a P&L. So I think it has really to do with how do you measure that increased productivity and health and happiness inside buildings. And I think there's a lot of work to be done in that field.
It's interesting because I suppose if you think about it in that context, actually that most organizations would have somebody with line item responsibility for cost management of real estate and workplace. And if you're responsible for it, I guess there aren't many boards around the world who are going to give that person more budget to spend freely. But who is it who has responsibility for the output? What I'm trying to get to is that the majority of facility managers and real estate managers are responsible for cost management. That's what they're driving, and they're always going to be driven downhill. Whereas if you came to the table and the same professional was responsible for output per employee, rather than cost per square meter, it would be an entirely different rules of engagement.
And it's quite interesting. We've done quite a number of buildings. And, you know, if you look at aesthetics or a green wall inside a building or inspirational design things, what's the value of that? If you're a facility manager and your KPIs are to drive down costs, you couldn't care less because it's not within your KPIs. And it's interesting. You step inside a building and we have quite a few buildings where we really look at the inspiration and the experience you had through that building, and you always get a reaction. The CEO steps in and he says, wow, yep, this is where I want to be. And then you got the facility manager and the CFOs who are looking at that single item and see only the bottom line thing and not the top line, that are often giving the pushback. So we've tried to put a lot of work into also making tangible that results and showing them. Tim, you're obviously aware of the study we've done together with Leisman and with KPMG on one of our buildings, which has become a case study in a recent World Green Building Council report, where we've used the Leisman index to measure the perceived productivity or increase in productivity between an old building and a new building that we've developed, and then used KPMG's true value methodology to really also monetize the effect. And this is a first effort being done where we also put money to it, and you always have to treat it with a certain relativity because of that. But I was amazed to see that that study actually showed that the increased productivity of the 1,100 people working in this particular building paid 10 years worth of rent in that building. And to me, that gives the order of magnitude of the effects that we're actually looking at. So to me, it's not surprising that the WELL standard, that BREEAM starts to look very much at it, that Leisman is coming up, because these are the tools that we need to tell that story. And if we just start treating it as short-term, cost-driven things, we will always end up at the bottom. But what we have to keep in mind is that buildings are objects of long-term value, and they're built for people. And if we keep these things in mind and we start to look much more not only at the cost, but on the long-term effects of them, both cost but also the revenues, what a good building could bring, and we start to develop the tools and the language to talk about and then show those results, I think we'll actually end up in a much, much better place.
At those magnitudes, we're talking about almost neutralizing the whole cost impact of workplace. And I guess in the hands of somebody like KPMG, this is gold dust to you, to be able to talk to prospective occupiers of new buildings, development partners on new properties, about that level of organizational impact.
Absolutely. And what the interesting part is that when I talk to real estate professionals or facility managers of larger companies, when you talk about them, they're really happy because from their experience, they see the effects of a good building versus the effect of a bad building. It's not being made tangible, but if you're doing this for 15, 20 years, you know what the effects are and you see it. And they are often frustrated by the fact that they can't express it in a proper way and that their dialogues with the CFOs are always about cost and not about revenue. So I think it's actually also a liberating tool, because the experience of professionals in this field is very much already, they know that a good building will bring these effects. But the trick is really to find the objective measures and the language to communicate through it and to also start putting that into the whole dialogue. But to me, it is really an intriguing but still burgeoning field.
Mm-hmm. So the WELL standard takes this even further, doesn't it, in terms of focusing back on the individual employee and the experience that an employee has in their time within the workplace. What's your sense in the Dutch marketplace about that type of refocusing on an employee's sense of well-being and purpose in the work environment?
To me, it is the next big wave in building and sustainability. And we've had a very big focus on energy in buildings. And for instance, when I take the Dutch building codes, we're looking at energy neutrality of anything we build by 2020. So we have to solve that thing just from a regulation perspective on. And we can. I mean, so there's a lot of work has been done and tremendous things. There's still loads to be done in the existing stock. But when you're looking at new build, that's the next thing. And what you've seen that a lot of developers in 2008, 2009 jumped on the bandwagon of sustainability also because of the marketing value and the USP it gave them. And it's interesting to see we're now in 2017 that sustainability in that way and energy performance, etc., is not so much a USP, it's a given. If you have to do it, it's market standard, we know how to do that, etc. So people are also in the industry looking at what's next, how can we distinguish ourselves, and I think health and well-being is definitely the next big thing where you can make the difference more, also because the potential gains are so big, as we just discussed. It's great to see a standard like WELL coming up, because health and well-being is a really multifaceted aspect, and you have to look at anything from lighting to acoustics to interior air quality, thermal controls, etc. And there's a whole bunch that not only individually impact on health and well-being and productivity, but also work together. So it's a field where you really have to know what you're doing, and where I think we also have to learn quite a lot of things. So having the tools and the measurements to do that is also important in learning how do you make a building more healthy and productive. What I like about WELL that it takes the users into account, that it also looks at aspects of food, for instance, which I think is a massive thing. And it brings the whole discussion to a much higher level. And I like that because as an industry, I think we have much to learn, or maybe relearn even. Because when I look at the great buildings in this world, they were actually built in a quite a different era, where the driver wasn't the cost budget, but very much a desire to put something lasting in there. But if it would bring back the quality of the whole building sector, if it would bring in the know-how, and if it would refocus on human being, I think we are really bringing back the value of the building sector in a much better way.
So the Dutch have been long looked at as innovators in the sector. If we think about Interpolis and Microsoft as some of the very, very first well-publicized activity-based working spaces, is there a future sort of commoditized version of what we're talking about now in terms of better quality buildings, so the sorts of buildings that you're putting up? Can we start to expect to see those getting further north into Northern Europe or further east into the US? Is there an interest that you've seen from other markets in a quality of design process and construction that you're doing here?
It's quite interesting to see that we have had a lot of international attention to, for instance, a project like Park 2020. It's so much that it actually spun off a consulting business also from our own business, where we teach our best practices from what we've learned across the globe. And there's quite a lot of interest in this kind of thinking and this kind of building, which we gladly share also, because I think it's important to try to be as open source as you can, because when you share, you always get something back as well. I think that is actually the way forward. Also because building is, there are quite a lot of stakeholders, you need to get the different insights and also learn from the things that don't go well.
Mm-hmm. We're sat in Plantronics' new European headquarters that we've had as long an association with as you have, in a funny way, through the early adoption by Plantronics of the Leesman Index standard. This is something very different. I mean, the client set out to build an acoustic temple, I think he phrased it when I first discussed it with him. What does this represent for you as a case study, individually, in the relationship with Plantronics?
Plantronics is a fantastic client for us. If we continuously want to improve ourselves, there's always a part of our development process which we call stretch, where we want to take one aspect and together with our clients dig that out deeper, find the world's best specialist we can. And in this case with Plantronics, we could do the work on acoustics, which is really, really an interesting thing. And it's for us a massive eye-opener also in the impact and the value of acoustics on productivity and well-being inside the building. We've had the privilege to work with some of the world's best specialists on this field, like Julian Treasure, for instance, who's done tremendous work and knowledge, and really an eye-opener. And both in the active and the passive measures and all the different shapes that's taken form, it's been an absolute delight to do it. So we've learned a lot from it, and it's fascinating to be able to work with a client like that and to be pushed and empowered to build a building like this. So yes, we're truly excited, and those are really invaluable lessons that we will hopefully repeat.
So are there some specifics that, for anybody who's not fortunate enough to be able to grab a visit out to Hoofddorp and see the building, are there some two or three things that you could pick out that you think, in terms of that learning and crowdsourcing or cascading that knowledge out to the community? Well, give us two or three things from an acoustic perspective that any new tenant moving into a building should take as gold dust in investing in.
It's interesting. We've quite often had the negative aspects of it in a number of other buildings, where you're looking at the hard materials and which look very nice from an aesthetic point of view. But particularly when you have buildings that are much more aimed at communicating, where you have different zones in for different activities, acoustics and can create massive stress both on a subconscious level, but also on a conscious level, when, for instance, someone next to you starts to talk on a telephone call, etc., and it disturbs your concentration, etc. So different zonings, but also the shape of materials and angles in a building. So it's not only the material itself, but also the shape and the way you deflect it. And we've done some work with active strategies where we create some white noise in the background to sort of mask sound. So we've used all different strategies. And the result is actually that what it does, it lowers subconsciously your stress levels and thereby improves your well-being inside a building. But it also allows for much higher density and productivity inside the building, because the building can be used in a much more effective way, because you don't bother each other that much once the acoustic strategies are in place and are well executed.
What we're hearing and seeing in our work in the Dutch marketplace is some sort of shifting sands in the organogram of who has responsibility for property. You know, there are some businesses that we're alongside where HR now, as an example, has the governorship for employee experience, and employee experience within the building envelope is therefore seen to be sitting under them. But any insights or experience or advice, if we've got a client listening to this podcast, you know, a more contemporary way of arranging that supply chain internally within an organization?
Well, traditionally you have the facility manager, and they quite often report to the CFO. What we see is that there's a shift that it's not only the CFO, or maybe not even the CFO, it's quite often HR, which is also involved and responsible for this. And I think when you're looking at Holland and you look at its demographic makeup, where we're actually looking at a shrinking working population, where that war for talent will only become more intense, and that where younger generations also have much more ability to choose. And from a competitive point of view, the workplace and the quality of the workplace is becoming more and more very important. So by putting HR in that field, the focus will also automatically shift to buildings that are more healthy and more productive and offer much more experience for their users as a tool to attract talented staff. And you've seen this already starting a little bit in an earlier cycle. It's something that also works much more in an upgoing market when there's a bit more space. You see still tenant going back into much more defensive modes once and short-term decisions if the stock goes down or if the market goes down. But I think in the long run, particularly through the demographic makeup of Western markets, this will become much more an important aspect of it, and which will also be seen almost as a condition for people to want to come to work for a company. Interestingly enough, we've done a number of tests also, and we've seen spikes of more than 200% with people coming into our buildings in terms of spontaneous applications of people wanting to work with that company because of their workplace. And I thought that we never anticipated such a spike, but it's a nice effect, and you see what effect it has also on the ability and how that building and that workspace also helps people identify and be proud of that employer, but also how it positions that employer inside the labor market.
I think you've also got to trust that an employer at whatever level, whether it's a director of HR, a CFO, or a CEO, who has the data presented to them that positions that building as a tool in competitive advantage, whether that's through the way that an employee can perform once they've been hired, or the fact that it's attracting better and higher quality talent to it in the first place, that actually they're going to start to see real estate as an asset in organizational performance, as a tool in competitive advantage, way more than an organization who have failed to recognize that linkage.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. I think it's in an you see, I mean, the when you look at offices, the whole role of the office has changed tremendously in the last 10, 15 years, mainly driven by the changing technology, which has enabled us really to work time and place independent. And the first wave was to sort of say, well, we were sort of the idea of what they called in Holland Nieuwe Werken, the new way of working, which meant like much more open space. You didn't have your own spot anymore. You were encouraged to work partly at home, etc. But actually, that was driven very much from a cost saving perspective. And now we see people starting to be much more aware that the building is actually becoming really a meeting place where you connect with your colleagues, where you build your company's culture, where you connect with your clients, etc. And the whole notion that different activities should be facilitated within that building, so the rise of activity-based working. But it's also the experience that people have and the identity the building lends to the company and the company to the building. I think that in that way, given the fact that people don't need to be per se at the office, it also becomes a tool to enforce and create company identity and culture. And I think that is a very important tool. And I think in that way, it would be very unwise for any company that wants to survive in an ever faster changing world, not to be aware that your company's culture, the way you project your company, is very important to maintaining your people. And in the end, it's your people that are the true success of your company.
So let's talk for a second around activity-based working and new ways of working. You've touched on it a number of times in our conversations prior. The idea of new ways of working in the Netherlands is almost so old that it can't possibly be new anymore. Are the Dutch looking for the next wave? Is there something that's coming after activity-based working whilst the rest of the world catches up with what ABW is? You're here thirsty trying to find something else. Give me some insights on ABW from your perspective.
Well, I think what you see, I mean, there's obviously you got the laggards and you got the front runners in there, but a lot of companies have gone through the process of new working and they have seen the benefits from it, but they definitely also have seen the negatives of it. And the negatives obviously are that by doing that, it's the disturbance of people, that you're not always empowered to find the space inside the building that you need to perform your task, or that you have to run in very early in the morning to even get a spot, which is totally detrimental and actually pushes people away from the office. So where we've gone through a cycle where you saw the average spatial requirement per person going down, we actually see it going up again because people start to adapt to activity-based work and see the logic of it and see the necessity also of it, that you have to create different zones for different types of work inside your building and facilitate that. But also because they see that if you push people too far away from the office, the organization starts to lose traction, the identity goes sort of overboard, and it's not only control, but most particularly you get inspiration by sitting face-to-face. And it's still, I mean, despite the advantage of video conferencing, conference calls or whatever, there are many ways you can cooperate, but if you want to truly get something done quickly, there's no substitute still for sitting together. And a lot of people see that. And it's interesting that notion of activity-based working is really picking up, also because of the way it has been to sort of repair the mistakes of the past. There's a second wave, which I think is also quite interesting, is that people start to, and this is particularly with younger generations, where they want to have the experience, where food and coffee are very big binders inside, where they expect fitness to be there. So it's this whole notion where the line between private and work starts to fade, but not in the sense that we push people to work at home, but much more bringing your life also inside the office. And I think that makes for more attractive and interesting workplaces. I think it also asks for much more mixed developments than monoculture developments. It opens up the notion of sharing facilities between different companies, where you can, and that's where area developments become much more interesting. So I think in the end, we'll hopefully end up with much more quality, much more interesting areas. And I really think that the next step is not only looking at the building, but also looking at it from an area perspective and seeing how can you facilitate all those different needs, where you take in mobility into account, where you take in leisure and food, etc., into account. And I think those are the big notions where work and private life are sort of shifting in a nice way, because in the end, it ends up with people. And who are we, and what is it, what is the way we like to spend that time? And I, for sure, would like to do that in a diverse, interesting environment rather than a box where I lock the door and just stay in my own.
That's interesting. We have a client who talks not about working from home for his teams, but actually about homing from work.
Yeah.
And the idea that actually there should be a permeability and a sort of fuzziness to the edges between what is work and what is home life, not to the point where he's trying to invade people's private time with work, but the idea that actually in this sort of, you know, always on society that we live in, it's actually very difficult to disconnect at any one point totally from either home life when one's at work or work life when one's at home.
Well, if you look at on an even higher level, I think it is really sad if in the morning you either put on your suit or whatever, your sweater or whatever you put on, and you go to work and you start to put up your work face. It is, to me, essentially you're the same. And if your workplace allows you to be the same, you don't have to play that role. I hate it when people say, yes, I see the value of it, but within my role, I cannot allowed is, that's a horrible thing. It means that as a person, your values aren't aligned with what the company wants. And if the workspace is such that those barriers are being taken away, that we can take off our masks and become much more ourselves, I think that would be a much healthier way and a much happier way to do our work.
That's brilliant. I think that sounds like a brilliant place to end as well. So really appreciate your time. Thanks very much for the dialogue, and I hope our listeners find it really, really useful.
Thank you. Thanks, Greg. Thank you very much, too.